Was that pre or post bank run? Economic data with an asterisk. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, March 30th. Good to have you with us. The big economic indicator of the day is GDP, gross domestic product, which the Commerce Department tells us grew at an annualized rate of 2.6% in the final months of last year. That's revised ever so slightly down from an earlier estimate of 2.7%. And it reflects what turned out to be the weakest growth in consumer spending since the start of the pandemic. Consumers being, of course, the big driver of economic growth in this country. Again, that's looking at the last quarter of 2022. Tomorrow, we'll get some fresher numbers on personal spending in February of this year. I say fresher because I probably don't have to remind you of what's happened in the economy since then. But just in case, Marketplace's Matt Levin will.
Okay, so pretend for a second it's February again. You know, back when you associated the phrase bank run more with that old movie It's a Wonderful Life than with startup CEOs freaking out on a WhatsApp thread. Back then, the big question for economists like Bank of America's Aditya Bhave was, is consumer spending picking up?
Because January was just extraordinarily strong.
The February consumer spending numbers we get tomorrow will tell us whether January was some sort of binge shopping anomaly. Now, all that spending obviously occurred before March banking madness, but Bhave says you shouldn't expect future consumer spending to just fall off a cliff.
The consumer impact is going to play out somewhat slowly.
Tomorrow, we'll also get new inflation numbers. Pre-SVB, the conversation around the Fed would be, okay, was inflation still high enough to warrant more rate hikes? Now the conversation is, do we need to raise rates more if all this banking chaos is kind of doing the job for us? Shannon Seary is an economist with Wells Fargo.
Conditions have tightened more significantly since the banking crisis, and that's going to impact March and then data going forward.
The one data point coming out tomorrow that will include the impact of Silicon Valley Bank is the Consumer Sentiment Survey. From what Jesse Wheeler sees at Polling Firm Morning Consult,
consumer sentiment data has dropped pretty considerably in the last couple of weeks.
Wheeler says that reverses several months of us feeling better about where this economy was going. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Wall Street was already looking ahead to the weekend, I guess. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Labor shortages in all sorts of fields have been a common thread in the pandemic recovery economy. In some fields, that crunch may soon get a lot worse thanks to some big federal investments. Last year's Inflation Reduction Act will channel hundreds of billions of dollars into clean energy projects, including tax credits for wind and solar power and rebates for making homes and businesses more energy efficient and upgrading electrical systems. Problem is, it's going to be kind of hard to electrify America without a lot more electricians. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that story.
At an office park near Washington, D.C., a group of high school students spends afternoons huddled around workbenches, wearing safety goggles and helmets, learning to carefully strip wires and run them through conduit. Among the students at Independent Electrical Contractors Chesapeake, an apprenticeship and training organization in suburban Maryland, is 18-year-old Mia Clay.
This is like the metal wire, and we had to like cut it open and twist it off and then put the red cap on it and then like screw on this little attachment. And then I think today we're going to learn how to put it in the box and stuff.
Students training to go into the skilled trades were in short supply even before the influx of funding from the Inflation Reduction Act. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the U.S. currently needs about 80,000 new electricians every year.
A lot of the labor force in skilled trades is older and is retiring. And that's just a natural fact of life.
Joshua Hawley is a professor at The Ohio State University who researches workforce development. He says those retiring electricians aren't being replaced with younger workers. And we might not notice the shortage when it comes to big marquee projects funded by the IRA, like, say, a giant battery plant.
You're probably going to be able to pay the wages that are going to attract the skilled labor that's going to come.
But when it comes to smaller projects, installing solar panels on businesses, heat pumps in homes, EV charging stations at apartment buildings.
My guess is I think you're going to have a bit of a harder time.
Because electricians who do those things are already struggling to meet demand. Mark Doles is vice president of MR Electricians in Rockville, Maryland. He has almost 36 electricians on staff, several apprentices in training, and...
We just purchased another electrical contractor because we couldn't find people. So we purchased another contractor basically just for their manpower.
Doles has a solid recruitment pitch. With no experience, start as a helper at $17 an hour, get 4 years of fully paid and paid for training, then a bump to $26 an hour, plus a 401k, life insurance, health insurance.
I have electricians that work for me that make over $100,000 a year. So, I mean, they're doing very well. I mean, they're making very, very good livings.
But there's something that hurts his ability to recruit. Stigma.
For quite a while, it's been viewed that we were blue collar, we're not intelligent, you do grunt work, and it's the furthest thing from the truth.
Young people aren't usually the ones balking at going into the trades. Paula Baylor, the workforce development manager at IEC Chesapeake, says it's usually their parents.
If you are generations of family that's going to college, you think that's the path for the next one in line. Everybody wants an electrician, but they want somebody else's kid to be their electrician.
Baylor warns that the shortage will make those IRA projects cost more and take longer to get done.
It's going to raise the wage, but it won't only raise the wage for the best electricians. It'll raise the wage for all electricians because you're going to need bodies on job sites.
In addition to class stigma, the trades have some gender diversity issues. 18-year-old Mia Clay is one of just a handful of girls in her program, and she stands out a bit. With perfect makeup, curly hair tucked under her helmet, and a star sticker on her cheek.
I look like pretty girly, but I like to do things with my hands like I'm going to do it. I'm a hard worker.
I point out we have matching French manicures, and Clay responds that part of why she wants to be an electrician is so she can make enough money to live the kind of life she wants. House in the suburbs, financially comfortable.
But like, I want to keep getting my nails done, so I don't see why not. Like, I don't have to change myself just to be in the field. Like, I feel like I don't have to make myself like less feminine to be in the field.
And to fill all the green energy jobs that are coming, the field needs Mia Clay and many more like her. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Another workforce shortage now. Childcare in the U.S. is among a family's biggest expenses, on par with housing and food. But as expensive as it is, most early childhood educators are barely paid a living wage. And a lot of them are leaving their jobs. That workforce has shrunk by 6% in the past 3 years nationally. In Massachusetts, it's down 10%. From WBUR in Boston, Carrie Young reports now on the challenge of finding and keeping those essential workers.
People who run childcare centers and hire teachers can speak directly to this labor shortage. Bernadette Davidson has been at the Boston Chinatown Neighborhood Center for 50 years.
I'm going to go to the fifth floor.
She shows me a classroom that's empty, except for two adults doing paperwork, sitting in tiny desks meant for toddlers.
You're looking at a room that used to hold 20 children, and because we have not been able to find teachers, we've had to leave it vacant.
Davidson tells me that in some cases, the teachers who left the center took jobs in the suburbs that paid a dollar or two more. But some just left the field because they couldn't make ends meet. That's what happened to Anna Rogers.
I've been working for about 10 years in childcare. I no longer do. Definitely the pay is a big factor. Like, you cannot work in childcare and have your own house. You can barely, if you're lucky, have an apartment to yourself.
Most candidates for these jobs are highly educated, like Kimberly Artez.
I have a MED, Masters of Education. Then I have an MS degree. Then I have a bachelor's degree, and that is in human services. And last but not least, I have an associate's degree in early childhood education.
Artez says while she did learn a lot earning those degrees, they didn't help much in the way of salary. She says her highest annual income in 20 years has been $38,000. And if you're a single parent, like Kaya Savannah in Boston, that doesn't go far.
I work at Ellis Early Learning Center. I teach 4- and 5-year-olds. I do have a 2-year-old at home who does come to Ellis as well.
Especially since you have to like fit daycare in your own life now. What types of financial adjustments have you made to make all of that work?
The last decision was to cut my hours. Cutting my hours meant getting paid less, but it allowed me to qualify for a subsidized slot so I can afford a slot for my child.
Savannah's struggle is something that Vanessa Pashkoff in Western Massachusetts can relate to. She and her husband went into debt paying for childcare for one of their 2 children. She says her decision to switch careers was agonizing, even though the work was exhausting and underpaid.
But I also want people to really hear the other side, like the rewarding side. There was a student who, he was making this big structure, and I went over and I said, wow, can you tell me about this structure? And he put his hand on his hip and he was wearing a boa and he flipped the boa over his shoulder and he said, it's the statue of Little B, duh, in New York City. I was like, oh, the statue of Little B, like how amazing.
Like Pashkoff, Boston teacher Kaya Savannah says she may soon have to leave also. She's waiting until her daughter turns 5 and ages out of the program where she teaches. Then she'll look for another job.
Is it something that I really want to do? It's not. I love teaching at this level, but things are going to get harder for me.
She says her household expenses will only increase as her daughter gets older. So leaving childcare for another career feels like her best choice. In Boston, I'm Carrie Young for Marketplace.
I'm forever going to call it the statue of Little B. So cute. And an update on that empty classroom we heard about at the beginning of the piece. It has kids in it again. Carrie tells us the Boston Chinatown Neighborhood Center just hired a full-time teacher. Coming up.
I don't know anything more volatile than a rental market.
Can't argue with that. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 141 points, 0.4% to finish at 32,859. The NASDAQ picked up 87 points, 0.75% to close at 12,013. And the S&P 500 added 23 points, just under 0.6% to end at 4050. Looks like Bed Bath & Beyond may be circling the drain. The retailer announced it plans to sell $300 million worth of new shares and that it, if it can't, it's likely to file for bankruptcy. Bed Bath & Beyond wrung out 26%. The American family that owns a controlling interest in the English Premier League soccer team Manchester United has been entertaining offers from potential buyers. And the club just got a little more attractive. It reported revenues for the second quarter were up more than 20% and it turned a profit. Manchester United scored just shy of 2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. One of the big questions 3 years into this pandemic is how many of the changes it triggered and how and where we want to live are going to last. Some new data today from the Census Bureau about where people moved last year sheds some light on that question. The Sun Belt, still extremely popular, a trend that started well before the pandemic and accelerated when COVID hit. But another trend of people leaving big coastal cities now looks like maybe it was just a blip. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
Remember those first eerie months of the pandemic when New York and other big cities were emptying out? And the many months after that, that there was talk people would never come back? Well,
there seems to be a return, not a huge return.
But William Fry, a demographer at the Brookings Institution, says no more big exodus either.
In San Francisco, there's still a population loss, but only a tiny one compared to a very significant one last year. But in the case of Manhattan, it went from a big domestic out-migration to a slight in-migration.
There were similar trends in other city centers, too, in Seattle, Denver, and Dallas. Fry says there are two main things going on. For one, fewer Americans are leaving these cities.
And then in addition, there's been a big increase from immigration from abroad.
3 years into the pandemic, though, Nicholas Bloom at Stanford University says he finds it striking there hasn't been a bigger reversal.
The pace of leaving has slowed down, but we're definitely not returning. And that tells you that work from home is here to stay.
At least a couple of days a week. And he says that's enough to change where people live.
Think of classic bankers, techies, managers. They don't need to come into the office 5 days a week. So they're thinking, why not move out to the suburbs?
That's one pandemic trend that's persisting, he says. Luke Rogers at the Census Bureau says another is people's desire to live in warm, sunny places.
Of the top 10 fastest growing counties in the country, all of them were in the South or in the West. And a big chunk of them were in Texas.
The rest were in Arizona and Florida. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Like politics, they say all real estate is local. But lately, there has been an interesting regional pattern, not unrelated to some of those migration trends Sam was telling us about. The latest home price index from research firm Black Knight shows that in January, home prices fell in every major market west of Colorado, plus Austin, compared to the year before. To the east of Colorado, home prices rose year over year. It's a split pretty much down the middle of the country. And right on the dividing line is the state of Texas, where Letitia Grant is executive managing broker at TAS Realty Group. We check in with her from time to time for The View from Houston. Welcome back to the program.
Great to be here.
How would you describe the Houston market right now?
Oh, my goodness. So we are at a very interesting point where prices are starting to decline and buyers are now getting back into the market in many of our areas.
Well, that's maybe good. I mean, you had been kind of waiting for things to cool off enough to make housing more affordable for a lot of your clients. Is that happening even with higher interest rates?
We absolutely have been waiting a very long time. Like, we've been waiting since the pandemic. And, you know, for real estate, 6 months is a long time. So imagine 2 years.
Yeah.
We've been struggling. Our poor buyers, many of them renewed their lease for a minimum of a year. And now they're at a place where they can get back into the market and they're entering.
As I mentioned up top, we're seeing kind of an unusual split in the housing market, East versus West. Where do you see Houston falling? You said prices have been cooling a little bit.
Yes. So even for our lower end buyers, we had not seen prices below the $240,000, $250,000 price mark. However, today I have a buyer that's approved for $195,000. Now, had this been 6 months ago, we would not have even been able to find her a home. But I've had the opportunity here recently to show her 10 homes.
Wow.
Yep. Several of which have been on the market for about 60 days.
So not flying off the shelves the way they were just a year ago, really.
That is correct. It has drastically changed for the buyers. It's drastically changed for the better. For the sellers, it has not so much changed for the better. It's now they're having to deal with, oh my goodness, we have to actually entertain doing repairs. We have to entertain maybe paying buyers' closing costs. Now, I will say, though, in some of our markets, that's not exactly the case. So our lower end groups, you know, that may be utilizing down payment assistance, the sellers are entertaining it. But for our middle income, they are moving a little faster.
What kinds of conversations are you having with clients now that mortgage rates have been kind of volatile lately with the recent bank failures and uncertainty about the future of lending in this economy?
Yeah. Now, my conversations may be a little different than your second buyer, your move-up buyer, but many of my buyers are coming from renting. And I don't know anything more volatile than a rental market. So that is the conversation. But just in general, you know, interest rates are what they are. And at the time that you're ready to purchase a home, interest rates could be 5%, they could be 6%, they could be 7%. When my mom bought her home, interest rates were 13%.
Yeah.
However, what I will say for certain is if home ownership is of interest to you and you can afford to purchase a home, you cannot allow an interest rate to stop you from purchasing that home. You pay 100% interest rate when you're a renter. So, you know, to hear a 6%, a 7%, you know, we're not really used to a 3, 4% interest rate market. So that's really something that was uncommon and it just kind of came. And just as fast as it comes, it's going to leave.
Right. We have to remember that that was a historical anomaly, but we got kind of used to it.
Correct. Correct.
So here we are talking in late March, spring and summer, you know, the market typically does pick up and there are typically more listings this time of year. But, you know, there's a lot of talk that people who own houses and bought their house with a really low mortgage rate or refinanced into a really low mortgage rate may be reluctant to sell. I mean, do you expect that typical pattern to happen this summer with more listings coming on?
I don't. I've had conversations with several sellers wanting to sell their home, buy a new home, and they honestly cannot get what they purchased for what they are paying currently. So they're a little more reluctant to sell. Now, as far as it relates to Houston, with the amount of vacant land that we have, we are so fortunate in that we can just look at our builders to build more.
Well, Letitia Grant with TAS Realty Group, always great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Same here. Thank you.
The United States isn't the only country that's been facing a shortage of affordable housing. The cost of renting a home is rising in many parts of the world. And in Ireland, the problem has become so serious, many young people are considering leaving the country, as the BBC's Leanna Byrne reports.
In Dublin, rent has gone up by nearly 14% in the last year, according to the property marketing website daft.ie. At the end of 2022, people were paying, on average, nearly $3,000 a month. Alex Casson works in banking and recently moved to the city.
Because there is just nothing out there, you sort of have to accept whatever's on offer, really. Otherwise, you could be ended up homeless or having to live in temporary accommodation.
The competition for rented properties that do become available is fierce. Rebecca is 32 and works in the tech sector in Dublin. When she advertised for a roommate, she wasn't prepared for how desperate people were.
Coming with cash in hand, with presents. Someone showed up at like 11 p.m. on a Friday night. I felt really unsafe, to be honest. It kind of had the opposite effect. I was quite angry. I just felt my privacy was completely invaded.
She was so traumatised by the experience, she's afraid to give her full name. Ronan Lyons is an economist at Trinity College in Dublin. He says, ironically, the current high rental prices are a result of the financial crisis back in 2008.
The Irish economy did crash, but then rebounded very strongly. But it rebounded without really adding any new rental homes. And as a result, rents in Dublin and indeed in the other Irish cities have more than doubled over the last 7 or 8 years.
Workers for global tech companies like Google and Facebook, which moved to Dublin to take advantage of Ireland's low corporate tax rates, have also increased the pressure on the housing market. Ronan Lyons says since the pandemic, even the country's smaller cities have become unaffordable for many.
If you look in Limerick or Waterford, the fourth and fifth biggest cities in the country, there are fewer than 10 homes available on the open market for rent at any point in time.
He says young people are struggling the most to find somewhere to live.
People in, say, their early 20s, you can get a clear sense of the anger that they feel that they've been left out of the housing system.
Now, according to research from the National Youth Council of Ireland, more than 70% of 18 to 24-year-olds are considering emigrating to countries like the US because they can't find or afford somewhere to live. I'm the BBC's Leanna Byrne for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today. Yesterday, we told you that the White House was preparing to call for new rules targeting mid-sized banks. Today, we have details. This afternoon, the Biden administration asked regulators to restore some rules that were loosened during the Trump administration. Those include requiring banks with between $100 and $250 billion in assets to undergo annual stress tests, hold more liquid assets, and create so-called living wills that plan how they would be wound down in the event of failure. Reuters reports the rules would affect less than two dozen banks out of a total of more than 4,000 insured by the FDIC. But as we've seen, they matter. Here's your moment of economic context. The average Wall Street bonus last year, bonus, was just under $177,000. That's the estimate released today by the New York State Comptroller's Office, and that's down 26% from the year before. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Babawi is the managing editor. I'm Amy Scott. We will see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.